Good afternoon. This is Terry Richard, TDH.
Hi, Terry. It's Donnie.
Hi, Donnie. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Great. Do you have anybody else on the line?
I think I'm the only one.
Oh, okay. I tried to call in earlier, but they won't let you call in until like 5 minutes before.
Really? Wow.
I know. It told me to hang up and try again later.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know that. How have you been?
Just busy. We have a multi-year plan that's due in a week, and it's just sucking all the life juices out of me. I'm sure you know how that goes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's definitely getting busier here. Good afternoon. Did someone join the call?
Yes, this is Janet Wilkinson from Reach of Dallas.
Hi, Janet. How are you?
Good. How are you? Who's this?
This is Terry Richard with TDHCA.
Hi, Terry.
And we also have Donnie Green on the line.
Hi, Donnie.
Hi, Janet. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
We're just going to wait a few minutes and see if others join us on the call.
And then tomorrow, Terry, just so you know, Paula and I will be on it together.
Great.
So, and then Friday I'll be on it by myself.
Okay. That's great. Really appreciate your participation. It's been an interesting process. I've gotten a few more people that are interested in wanting to perhaps sit in on the calls, but also just be more interested in what the council is doing. One of them is a professor up at University of North Texas.
Okay.
If you call, she's working with people with co-occurring mental illness.
Is her name Dr. Carey?
No, it's Dr. Natek.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Vicki Natek. We had a nice conversation. So,
okay.
So that's always good.
Okay. Because I just spoke with a student up there that's doing an advocacy project under Dr. Carey.
Okay.
And an advocacy booth on campus of housing opportunities for people with disabilities. And I just had about a 30-minute conversation with the student. She's going to try to make it down on Tuesday. I had to give her the sad but bad news that housing options in Texas for people with disabilities that don't fall under one of a few groups is very limited.
Yeah. And so what is she doing, an advocacy project?
Yes. She's putting together, she's wanting to put together an advocacy booth there on campus.
An advocacy booth. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Well, it's a project, but part of her project, I guess, part of the project guidelines was to prepare something, so she's putting together an advocacy booth.
Oh, that's really cool.
So,
I'd love it if she would share some of the information and what she's doing with us. That'd be great.
Well, when I she's gonna call me. I guess she works early mornings. She's gonna try to make it down on Tuesday. If I Terry, is there a phone number I can give her for her to call you and maybe y'all can have a one-on-one?
Oh, sure. My number is 512-475-2953.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that, Janet.
Yeah, I'll give that to her. Like I said, she's supposed to call me on Tuesday. Nothing's written in stone, but
okay.
I penciled her in on my calendar for early afternoon on Tuesday. So.
Oh, that'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Did somebody else join the call?
Mike Goodwin.
Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am alive, and that's all that allowed.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, listen, I know time is valuable, and we may have others join the call, but let's go ahead and get started with our final work group meeting for work group two. And so this is the group that's working on the rural development and mid-sized cities. And so I just want to go ahead and remind everyone that we are being recorded, and I've been posting those recordings on the website, the Housing and Health Services Coordination Council website. There is one audio that AT&T did not get record. Well, they did record it, but then they sent a cassette tape instead of a CD. And we don't have any equipment that plays a cassette tape anymore. Anyway. All of them except that one meeting are on the website. So let's just go ahead.
Now, are you doing this under contract with NSA?
That's right. So I wanted to go to jump right into it because what I anticipated was, and this is the first work group that's meeting, what I wanted to do was to share all of the recommendations with all three groups so that everybody could see what the other groups have developed. You can see there's some redundancies, but what I had planned to do was just really kind of walk through each one of them, and if there's any discussion, some of them are just real straightforward. We can have some discussion, or if as we move through and we kind of look through the list, we think of some others to add, then we could do that. Does anyone have any objections to that process?
Mm-mm.
Does that make sense to everybody?
Yeah, it works for me.
Okay.
Terry, have you already sent those out?
Yes. They're on the website. They are attached to the agenda. Are you in front of a computer?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. They're attached to the agenda. So if you go to, you know, the council website is program and services or services.
Okay, let me.
Council supported by TDHCA. And I'm sorry, I don't have any way to send it to you. I don't have a BlackBerry, but.
Okay, I'm on the TDHCA website.
And then if you go up to the top and click on programs and services, not the big three buttons, but the ones at the top, and then just hover over that and you'll see council supported by TDHCA or TDHCA supported councils.
Okay. I'm not finding that. I find the programs tab and the support and services tab, but I don't find the programs and services tab.
Gosh, I don't
and those are two different ones, and council doesn't appear under, TDHCA supported council.
And then it's the bottom one under that.
Yep. Okay. Yep, got it.
Okay.
And then meeting agendas and materials.
Uh-huh.
And let me see.
Well, no, it would be work group. I think it's committee meetings.
Committee meetings.
On the left-hand side, there's a navigator.
Mm-hmm.
So I think committee meetings.
Got it.
Great. Got it pulled up?
Yep. Obviously, I've spent hours reviewing that.
No worries. Well, I'll just go ahead and jump right in. And so if anybody wants to chime in, you all just jump right in too. The first thing was if the first item recommendation, and I'm starting with additional resources, I figured I'd start at the top and go to the bottom, is if there's any more Section 8 or 11 funding opportunities in the future, let's go for them. We're currently, just by the way, waiting for HUD to respond to our comments on the current Section 8-11 grant that Texas was awarded. And so we're hoping to hear back on that that cooperative agreement soon so we can get that program going. But the next item is coordinate with public housing authorities to look at trying to obtain additional HUD VASH or Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing vouchers. And I know that TAC, the Technical Assistance Collaborative, I believe, is expecting to have an announcement about additional vouchers that will be coming out hopefully in the not too distant future. The next one is to convene the continuum of care organizations across the state to look at ways to leverage funding. Then the next bullet is to coordinate with Department of State Health Services on their rental assistance and with TDHCA, Section 811, to look at analyzing and producing some data about those two programs and how they rolled out and look at any being able to try to put together some information about cost savings and how it impacted the quality of life to then be able to have some information to consider establishing in the future a state-funded rental assistance program. The next item is training for the Texas Apartment Association. I know TDHCA does partner with the Texas Apartment Association for trainings for our compliance. And this training would be specific to people with disabilities and being able to let the association members know about services that are available to support tenants.
Can I add something on that? As working at a center on independent living, when you say training for Texas Apartment Association, I think the other thing, I don't know if this was part of the training, but also disability sensitivity and awareness training, because I think that should also be part of that training, not just maybe housing issues, but how people first language and how to approach and discuss with people with disabilities.
I agree. Okay, great. Sensitivity training. You said something else besides sensitivity, and I'm sorry.
Sensitivity and awareness.
Awareness, yeah. Okay.
Which here at the center, the Dallas Center, we do that.
That's great.
So, I mean, not with the Texas Apartment Association, but if you're looking for organizations that do that, we are one of them.
Okay, that's great. Great. Okay. I should have numbered these, I realize, so I will make sure and do that on the next draft. So the next bullet is Coordinated Additional Housing and Services Partnership Academies. That, you know, we held the first one of those in May. Overall, I think it was successful, and so the recommendation is let's do more of those. Coordinate, the next item is coordinate with the Department of State Health Services as they implement their rental assistance program, including working with their local mental health authorities to become tenant-based rental assistance administrators. I know most of you know tenant-based rental assistance program is a program that folks can, leaving institutions can access until their name comes up on the project access waiting list or a Section 8 voucher. The issue is we don't have tenant-based rental assistance providers covering all the counties in Texas, so it would be good to expand that. The next bullet would be coordinate with DSHS as they implement their new home and community-based adult mental health program to be able to increase the utilization of project access vouchers for the DSHS pilot, and that's referring to money follows the person. Oh, I'm sorry, the Project Access DSHS pilot. We have 10 vouchers set aside, and we only have 2 of those that are being used. And so
So you've got about 150 or so on the wait list, and you've got 8 vouchers that aren't being utilized.
Eight vouchers for that were set aside for the pilot.
Yeah. Boy, that may be a policy that the larger group or PIAC may want to take up, because I know that there's tremendous support for transitioning folks out of state hospitals, but, you know, denying those slots to the folks who are in nursing homes, that really does kind of raise some equity issues. They have unutilized vouchers just sitting there.
Yeah, it's something to think about. I know that the last numbers that I shared, there were 10 total and that had been utilized at some point for that pilot.
Yeah.
But currently there's only 2. So there's different issues that have caused those vouchers to be used. So it's something to think about. And maybe with this new 1915I, it's the Medicaid, it's a state plan amendment actually, maybe that will help get those filled. The next bullet is to encourage DSHS to expand their rental assistance program to all local mental health authorities. They received approximately, I think it was $11.8 million, and they solicited applications from the local mental health authorities, of which there's 39, but only 18 were awarded or received funding to operate a rental assistance program. So this recommendation was to see if there's ways that they could expand that to all 39. The next item is expansion of the Aging and Disability Resource Centers through DADS. That really goes with the very last bullet under the additional resources for the work group one, which is balancing incentives payments. That is something that the state is moving forward with, which requires a no wrong door. And so the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, there is a plan to expand those across the state.
I'm curious why, I'm just kind of curious as working on a Center for Independent Living, why the state wouldn't look at including centers on independent living in that aspect of that.
It is.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
It's an open procurement available to all types of applicants. And I know there's a SIL that's currently in ADRC, and I'm assuming that there are other SILs that have applied to become one.
Okay. Thanks, Donnie.
Data. And Donnie, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, the SIL could also always, I don't know if the word partner is right, but they could certainly work with the ADRC in their area to be included. What's the term, Donnie?
Oh, it's partners.
Okay, right. So even if they aren't the lead agency, they could partner with their local ADRC, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So then the next bullet is expansion of the program for all-inclusive care for the elderly. In the last legislative session, DADS did receive funding to increase the number of those sites. And then the next bullet is the delivery system redesign incentive payment, DSRIP. And currently there are a number of projects that are being implemented across the state. They are focusing on behavioral health types of services. And so I know they are in, I think it's called DSRIP Year 3. And I believe it goes, I don't remember for sure how many years it goes, but they are really focused on behavioral health projects. And some of that does include some supportive housing in some areas. And then I mentioned already the no wrong door and conflict-free case management and the single assessment. Those are the three requirements for balancing incentive payment. So then work group two, you guys, most everyone, I believe everyone on the call has already seen these. So we can go through those, you know, pretty quickly. Help rural communities identify local resources and support collaboration of resources and funding. Create training for housing and services staff and developers in various formats, which we are in the process of doing. I know that it was Michael West that really pointed out, let's start with, in the report, some information about how much service-enriched housing is needed in rural areas and mid-sized cities. Third bullet, educate individuals on the definition of service-enriched housing. I've started the initial draft of the biennial plan, and that is where I'm starting with the plan, is what is it and why is it important. The next bullet is to increase points for developers to develop small, that would be less than 50-unit projects of service-enriched housing in rural communities. And this would be referring to the qualified allocation plan, I believe. And again, the next bullet is also to increase points for supportive housing. That would also be via the qualified allocation plan. Create points for developers who develop service-enriched housing. Next bullet is reestablish a rural housing expansion program.
Terry, can you refresh my memory on that? That's not ringing a bell.
Yeah, there's some information. I think it was called to, I sent out the link to the report that was done, and then there was a work, if that's the one I'm thinking of, there was a work group too, a rural housing work group.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to make sure I'm correct on that, because there was a program about rural housing. That may be the one that, Mike, you were talking about that was through HUD. I'm sorry, I need to clarify that one. There were a couple of different things. We did have a rural housing work group at one point, and then we did have an extensive report that was done about rural housing in Texas. Let me see if I can make sure I'm clear on that one. I'm sorry, Donnie, I need to clarify that one. It maybe was under the housing tax or the housing trust fund.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry, I'll clarify that one.
Oh, not a problem.
Yeah. Well, I just ran into one the other day that I'm going to actually work on it. The one we're doing is not tied to service-enriched housing, but the Rural Development section of the Department of Agriculture does have a mortgage insurance program for rural areas. It's under Section 538, I guess they call it 538 program, and it's a NOFA submission on an annual basis. But talking to the Texas RD office, USDA has never used all of the funding authority they have. And of course, all they're doing is loan guarantee, but what it does is it gets your interest rate down under 6%. And it gives you a guaranteed loan, which lets you go in at a little bit lesser rent. And if, somebody that wanted to get into this could go with that program and then pull in a couple of other strings, if you will, you might could get some of those units into the SEH world at favorable rents.
Hmm. So that would be, so let me say back and make sure I understand that. You said it was a mortgage insurance program?
Yeah, it's like the 221B3 or 221F that HUD runs, where USDA guarantees the mortgage.
Guaranteed.
And so you can get it underwritten at a lower interest rate than if you were just to go out on the market. Like right now, the last one I saw was an estimated 5.75%. loan amortized over 40 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so what that would mean would be a developer, you're saying?
A developer would then have a lower cost of debt, and if he could, I'll say, tie it in with a couple of state programs, particularly some of these that we're talking about now where there are service provisions brought to the property, you know, they might could do some sort of set aside of units in the SEH world.
Okay. That sounds great.
Which is counterintuitive to the 811 program, because it is a federal program that will put housing in a rural area, but they can't get 811 because it's not state financed.
No, I'm sorry. Say that one again, too.
Okay. Here is a program that will encourage development of housing in a rural area. So we'll say I built a 100-unit property down somewhere, Edinburgh, for example.
Okay.
And I say, hey, you know, I need a little bit more help, so let me get some rental-assisted units where I have a guaranteed rent, and with those rental-assisted units, that puts you in the SEH world under our 811 program. But you can't do that because the 811 program specifically is tied to state-funded projects and not federal-funded.
Are you talking about, when you say the Section 811, are you talking about that new grant?
Yeah, the new grant program that we're running where you know, we have vouchers available for projects that are developed with state funds, i.e. credits or state-issued bonds.
Okay, right. Our current, our existing properties and new properties, right?
Yeah.
It's project-based.
Yeah, it's project-based vouchers that can be tied to the project. But here's another funding source for programs that are specifically directed at rural areas.
Okay.
But you can't cross that funding line. I'll go back and we'll use 50 units. Well, if I could get 5 units with rental assistance, you know, that's 10% of my project with guaranteed rent. That helps me even further on my debt service.
I like to what you're saying.
And it lets me, you know, it lets me have a lower operating cost, a better survival, but the residents are only going to pay 30% of their income. So, you know, you've got a deep subsidy on those 5 units.
Okay.
But because it's a federally guaranteed program, there are no state funds in it as far as financing, so it won't qualify for our demonstration program.
Okay, I think I'm following you on that. Okay. Thank you, Mike. So the next bullet was to coordinate additional housing and services partnerships, so that was also a recommendation in Work Group 1. The next one would be a TDHC representative continue to participate on the State Independent Living Council, the CAP, or Council for Advising and Planning for Prevention and Treatment of Mental Health and Substance Use Disorders, PIAC, Community Resource Coordination Group, Sex Department of Criminal Justice. A couple of these, by the way, I added, so you probably haven't seen a couple of these. The Reentry Task Force to disseminate information about housing and services available to people with disabilities and aging Texans. You know, I go to many of these, and much of what I do is try to educate about service-enriched housing, try to educate about the different programs that are available for people with disabilities and aging Texans. So I added that in there because it's part of the education and training and technical assistance that's required in the statute. And then is it also a way to reach out to some people that represent the rural communities? So some of the folks, for example, on the CAP come from the rural areas of the state that participate. So it's just a really good avenue to be able to share and to do some cross-education of state staff and others. The next, or the last bullet for Work Group 2 was TDHCA continue to support the Texas Interagency Council for the Homeless and the Disability Advisory Work Group in order to identify housing and services needs in rural and mid-sized cities. Again, there's representatives on those councils and work groups that represent rural needs.
When you guys are developing rural needs, has anyone been in contact with the organization April?
April?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Well, April is the Association of Rural Programs of Independent Living in Rural America. I mean, their focus is Rural America. That is their only focus.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Tell me what the acronym was again, Janet.
Oh, you know, I don't want to get it wrong, so let me look it up. I don't want to.
That's okay. You've got my phone number, and my email is on our website.
It's the Association of Programs for Rural Independent Living.
Okay, thank you. You're fast.
Oh, I have their website as one of my favorites. I just have
okay.
to put it up.
Okay. Independent Living. Okay.
I mean, one of their main focuses is transportation, but if you're talking housing, you have to have transportation.
Right.
So, you know, it might, I don't know if they're a membership organization, so I'm just saying if it's something, you could always contact them when you're talking rural America and rural Texas.
Sure, that's great. I appreciate that. That's not one I'd heard of, or if I had, I hadn't captured it.
And I can send you contact information on that.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
Janet, appreciate that. Okay, so the last one, are we ready to go on? Did you all, since you are Work Group 2, and we do have plenty of time, as we've read through thus far, have you thought of others, any additional recommendations or thoughts to include in the plan?
My suggestions are, you know, to make sure that aging and disability resource centers and area agencies on aging have an opportunity to receive the training as well, especially the ADRCs, since they will have some responsibilities for housing navigation functions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. Oh, and I guess another one I should put in there related to training. DAD's staff reached out to TDHCA. They are creating a relocation specialist manual. And so I am in the process of trying to provide some easy-to-use information to be included in their manual. So that's another opportunity to cross-educate. So I can share that with everyone at one of our meetings. Okay. Well, let's just move on to work group three, and if there's and then we can go back, and if there's anything else that we've missed, we can add and continue the discussion. Work group three was about creating a series of incentives to expand service-enriched housing. So the first bullet under that is to encourage people with disabilities and advocates to participate in the qualified allocation plan process. And I specifically talked with the director of our multifamily unit here, and he came to the council meeting, Cameron Dorsey, and he said what would really be helpful is to provide some specific recommendations that could be included in the staff draft. And that is going to be coming up in about 2 months. So that's something we can talk more about at one of our council meetings, but I did want to include that in the plan because we will be looking at 2015 and 2016 qualified allocation plan, which is the plan that is the foundation for the housing tax credit, which is by far the most funding available for service-enriched housing. And then in the 2014 initial staff draft, we had included the Section 811 project rental assistance. But because we had not received the cooperative agreement from HUD at the time that that document was being opened for public comment, created, it went to the board with that included, the Section 811 project rental assistance included, but there were a number of people that spoke at the board, and the board made the decision not to include it in 2014, but definitely left open the door to include it for 2015. So we definitely have some work to do there, but that was the second bullet, is to include Section 811 in future QAPs. The third bullet is to review possible incentives in the QAP for for-profit corporations. The fourth bullet was to review possible incentives for developers who agree to provide an on-site case manager. There was a lot of discussion in Work Group 3 about that. Is it a contract? Would it be an employee? What exactly does a case manager do? So there was a lot of discussion about that. So that would be something we could continue to work on. The next bullet is review creating more incentives for deeply affordable housing, 20% area median family income.
Okay, so I have to be honest, I laughed when I read that.
Okay.
And the reason being is when it says review creating more incentives, what are the current incentives for people to develop 20% AMI housing?
Well, yeah, I see what you're saying. I know that there are incentives in the QAP currently, but I do think it's for 30%.
Right, and it's those are even few and far between in the DFW area because mm-hmm. I've had TDHCA pull me a tax credit report for every tax credit property and what AMI their focus is on, and I bet I could get it on both hands in the DFW area how many minimal units are even at 30%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I mean, I literally
I hear you.
So, I'm just saying.
Sure. I hear you. The word more is not appropriate there, sounds like, in your opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Creating incentives for deeply affordable housing. Is that sort of where you're going?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. The next bullet is review policies relating to accessing affordable housing for persons who have a criminal history. And then related to that, this is on one of the work group calls, there the understanding, and I don't remember, I believe it was Darla that was on the call, that TDCJ, Texas Department of Criminal Justice, may have resources for persons with criminal histories for transitioning into the community. I know during the last legislative session they were provided funding to hire, I think it was an additional 45, and I'll not think of exactly what they're called, but transition specialists or transition case managers. That so there was some discussion about would there be a way to partner with TDHCA and TDCJ, you know, something that might look like a NOFA that would go out to our properties and that would be willing to look at accepting individuals with criminal histories, certain types of criminal histories, not all, of course, and then receive additional subsidy from TDCJ. So that was just something that was thrown out. I have not had a chance to follow up to see if, in fact, there are TDCJ resources, but we do have Naomi Trejo here at the department that does participate on the reentry task force with TDCJ. So that's something to continue working on, which is the last bullet. We do participate in that reentry task force. And, you know, I did point out during that call that we wouldn't be talking about anyone with a criminal history. For the work of the council, we're talking about people with disabilities and aging Texans. If they should also have a criminal history, then that would be, you know, different. That would be meet the definition of our current definition of service and reach housing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the list. What all do you think about that? Any additions? Do we want to have any more discussion about it?
Well, on the housing for folks with criminal history, we assist a lot of consumers who have criminal history, but it seems to me that the policies are fairly lax, where in most cases you're deferring to the policies of the housing authorities. And even if the housing authority policies are written to exclude folks with criminal history, there are review and appeal processes. So I guess I'm not clear on what would be within TDHCA's scope in terms of revising policies, because I don't think TDHCA is really imposing any barriers now. Again, I think that's the decision of the landlord or the housing authority.
Yeah, I think we do require them in compliance. We do require them to check criminal history.
And Donnie, I will agree with you, because working with Mavis, who does Money Follows the Person, you know, she'll either get a project access voucher or through Dallas Housing, who has set some aside for transitioning out of nursing homes, and so they get the criminal history passes the voucher aspect, or the holder of the voucher, whether it be Project Access or the housing authority, but then when it comes to criminal history at that particular apartment complex, they get denied.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of a personal responsibility girl. You know, if I do certain things, there may be consequences associated with that. So, again, I guess I'm just not familiar with any restrictive policies that TDHCA per se has in place. And we're just going through training for TIBRA, and I was surprised to learn that there's no screening done through TIBRA for either criminal history or credit, that the landlord assumes that responsibility. So, again, maybe it's just an education process on my part, but I do think that there's quite a bit of flexibility if you can find a landlord who will lease, and I do think that you know, the landlord does have rights to screen in order to protect the safety of other tenants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I probably would not want a next door neighbor who is an expert at setting up nest labs.
Yeah, well, in all of your rental assistance programs, in general, the agency providing the voucher screens only for program eligibility.
Right.
And rarely is criminal history any part of program eligibility, except in a couple of HUD programs where there is an absolutely verboten on sex offenders.
Yeah, and I think Project Access started screening for criminal history, and so that seems to be an exception to the rule, but... again, from a personal perspective, I have no problems with that.
Well, and most of the programs also exclude felony drug convictions. And then you go into felonies with violence against persons.
Mm-hmm.
And you get past those three, and then they can start getting lax. Or, you know, for example, a minor marijuana ticket's not going to get you excluded necessarily. Burglary may, but if you have somebody who's convicted of physical violence against somebody else, most of the landlords are going to screen them out. Mm-hmm. They'll screen those out. They'll screen felony drug convictions, particularly distribution, and they'll screen out sex offenders.
You know, we get calls from the public every day here. I don't know what we get, 800, 900 a month. And I have taken some of those calls where it's somebody who perhaps wrote a bad check back when she was 22, and she's like now 40 or something, and is being denied an apartment. And so, you know, that's just, I know that is something that's kind of an issue as far as time frame. Okay, so if I ever did it in my entire life, I get disqualified?
Yeah, and from my experience, folks who are in those situations are not being excluded. It's really the felonies that are problematic, and not in all cases. I mean, we've had housing authorities and landlords who've said, you know, that armed robbery was 30 years ago.
Right. And then allow it. So your point, you kind of started this part of the conversation with that they, you use the word, I think, lax, but it's flexible, right? Some of those policies can be flexible, like the felony charge. If it was 30 years ago, then some landlords will go ahead and accept somebody with that type of history. Is that?
Yeah, and from my perspective, what we're doing is coming up with recommendations for TDHCA. Is that correct? Or is it broader than that? I think that's really at the heart of my question.
I think I'll tell you my personal opinion, since we're talking about housing and services. I think it's beyond just TDHCA. I think it's bigger than just TDHCA.
Oh, I definitely think it's bigger.
And
but with the recommendations, are we to limit the recommendations to those that can be implemented by TDHCA, or is it advisable to come up with recommendations for downstream providers, for housing authorities, for landlords?
Okay, here's how I'm approaching it. I'm looking at from the perspective of who all we have represented on the council. So I'm looking at DADS, I'm looking at HHSC. I think our recommendations, that there's DARS represented on the council, that you have SILS represented on the council. So I think recommendations would be applicable to any of those organizations. Now, public housing authorities, none of the organizations that are represented on the council have any jurisdiction over the public housing
authorities. Right.
Well, but you get into the area of what I will call jawboning and best practices, where it can spread below that, but you may not have any direct authority over what they're doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, your laxity of screening criteria is directly proportional to your vacancy factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what you'll find in I'll say the real world of housing. If you got a vacancy problem, you get a lot of exceptions to your screening process because every one of them is written with a subject to review by a senior, you know, someone senior in the management.
I see. That makes sense. So, Donnie, back to your comment. I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Sort of looking back at, I think a number of these recommendations go outside of recommendations for TDHCA.
Okay.
Do you agree? Like I'm looking at the delivery system district and BIT. Those are
okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense to everybody?
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Well, we've gone through all the recommendations. Other recommendations, if there's something, someone.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering if you could expand on the, I guess it was work group 3, the first bullet where it says encourage people with disabilities and advocates to participate in the QAP.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys leaning towards, or what is the process that you guys are wanting to? Because I've read the QAP, and I belong to a national organization housing subcommittee that has QAPs all over the country. And when we had to submit our state QAP, I mean, he said, how did you read that? So as a person that I feel that I'm somewhat educated in understanding the QAP, the average Joe is going to look at that and have no idea what that means. Because it is a very hard document to read.
It is. I agree.
And it's way too long. So I'm just, I mean, I would love to have people with disabilities put their input, but when you're talking about trying to explain it, it's way complicated.
It is very complicated, and I guess to me that's some of the input that would be good for this department to have. It's complicated and it's too hard to read. Can you simplify it?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a number of the items that are in that qualified allocation plan are required by statute. Now, making it simpler and easier to read, that's a different story.
Right.
But that was certainly one of the things, and when Cameron Dorsey came and talked to the council, that was a comment that he made at the meeting, that we do not hear from people with disabilities. They do not provide input into the qualified allocation plan. And I guess that's something that for advocates, for all of us who are interested in service-enriched housing, really going to have to learn to figure it out.
Well, I'm just saying, in compared to other states' QAPs, ours is crazy. And I could probably gather the information that Mr. Brian Peters gathered from other states because he did this whole QAP research, blah, blah, blah.
I think I've seen that, Janet.
I bet you have.
I think I use that as one of my resource documents. And I think it went through all 50 states.
Mm-hmm.
And it had even a little table about it. Well, that was something that when, you know, I've had discussions is, okay, give us some specifics. So having some other states' examples of QAPs,
mm-hmm.
that'd be good to have. So, you know, maybe one of the recommendations might be to look at the qualified allocation plan from other states and look at ways that Texas's could be simpler, easier to read. I mean, could we make a recommendation out of where you're going with that, Janet?
I would think so. Okay. I mean,
help me out. Well, I think we could put in there review QAPs from other states, right?
And best practices of QAPs. I mean, I mean, because seriously, when I emailed Brian Peters, our QAP, he literally sent me an email back that was like, LOL. And I was like, yeah, you said you wanted us to read the QAP and send you a link, and here it is. And he's like, that's crazy.
And Brian Peters, I'm sorry, is who, Janet?
He's our chair for the NICHOL Housing Subcommittee. He's out of Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
He works with the center up in Wisconsin.
Okay, it would be great if you could send that information to me. I'd appreciate it.
Okay.
So I could put something together like review QAPs from other states, best practices related to QAP from other states, to consider simplifying, streamlining Texas QAP, something like that.
Yeah, and then I will send you Brian's contact information and the QAP stuff that he did.
Okay, that'd be great. Simplifying Texas QAP. Mike, do you have any comments related to that? Because
well, I was going to say that this reminds me of a federal government program of how you get your awards. The first five people get awards for writing these great programs with the restrictions that cover every element, and then the next guy that comes in is the guy that started it on the first, and he gets an award for throwing it out and streamlining it. Because if you think about the QAP, that's what the QAP is developed by. You know, there in the beginning there was one. And then every year, people tried to tighten it up and in some cases, open it up to more categories or to bring special things in here or special things in there or, award people for doing something or not doing something. Mm-hmm. And it gets to the point of when you have limited resources, the developers that want credits are going to pick things that they would never do in a sane world because it maximizes points. And maybe they should look at, as you say, streamlining it and getting it back to more basic that provides the legally required protections and set-asides but doesn't overly create new ones just because it sounds good.
Well, I mean, this has nothing to do with TDHCA, but when I'm in fair housing training and you have developers and builders sitting in there and they're wanting to know what the bare minimum that they have to do to meet fair housing design and construction guidelines, that's a problem. They should be looking at what they have to do to do the bare minimum. If they just did it across the board, everybody would be happy.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I've got that, Janet, and I'll add that bullet. And anything else from anyone? Any other suggestions?
I think you've given them about a year's worth of things to think about. Maybe.
it's a pretty long list. You know, I had anticipated having a couple of more of these phone calls, but then as I started looking at the list, I was sitting there thinking, that's a couple of years' worth of work at least. Okay, well, if we don't have anything else, I really appreciate everyone.
Now, don't get upset when you turn it in and they look at you and say, can you streamline this a little bit?
Well, I really do appreciate it, and just know that there's still opportunity to provide input. So if any of you think of things that I haven't included or changes, revisions, the next step is going to be to work on a rough draft of the plan and include these in the plan. Right now, the plan, how it's shaping up, is going to be starting with an introduction about what defining service-enriched housing. looking at supportive housing and other definitions that are similar, but what are the main ingredients, if you will, of service-enriched housing? The next section is going to focus on what does it look like, why is it important, who's using it, how do they benefit, is there cost savings? And so I'm looking at doing some, gotten some research about the cost of people living in institutions compared to people living in the community, in addition to quality of life. And I talked with a couple of you, you know, including some vignettes, real people, real stories of, you know, how it's affected them. And then moving on to what have we done to date. So really looking at some activities, just sort of putting in some bigger, broad categories, the work of the council to date, and then our recommendations and how we came to those recommendations. So the report's going to include some information about the Technical Assistance Collaborative and the process that we went through to identify these three goals, and then summarizing it all. How does that sound to everyone?
Excellent. I'll work on getting those couple things to you in the next couple days.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Thank you all very, very much.
You're welcome.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good rest of the week.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.